Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Little Green Men by Christopher Buckley. "10 seconds." John O. Banion stared unblinkingly into the TV camera's cyclops eye, keeping his famous cool under the baking glare of the videscence lights. It pleased him that he was more at ease than the person seated opposite him, who, as it happened, was the most powerful man in the world. 5 seconds. 3. 2. The theme music was cued, a variation on a Handel trumpet voluntary with echoes of Aaron Copland. The TV critic for the Washington Post had called it fanfare for the self-important man. Still, nothing like a few bars of brass to get the establishment's hemoglobin pumping on Sunday mornings as it sipped its third cup of coffee and scanned the newspapers for mentions of itself. Sunday! A satisfying opener, implying, as it did, ownership of the entire day, and the Sabbath at that. The announcer's voice was familiar. Ample Ampere, the sponsor, had wanted James Earl Jones, but Banion said that he couldn't hear the voice of James Earl Jones without thinking of Darth Vader, hardly an appropriate tone-setter for such a high-level show as his. Ampere countered with Walter Cronkite. "No, no," said Banion. "Cronkite, the beloved former TV anchorman, was too avuncular, too upbeat. The voice must have such gravity as to suggest that if you missed the program, you were not a serious person. Only one person would do. George C. Scott, the voice of General Patton."
"An exploration of tomorrow's issues with today's leaders. And now..."
Banion had dictated the slight pause in the manner of Edward R. Murrow's wartime "This is London" broadcasts.
"Your host, John Oliver Banion."
The Post critic had written, "Drumroll, enter Praetorians, household cavalry, concubines, elephants, rhinos, captured slaves, eunuchs, and other assorted worshippers." Banion looked owlishly into the lens through his collegiate tortoiseshell eyeglasses. He seemed perpetually on the verge of smiling without ever giving in to the impulse. He was in his late 40s, but could have been any age. He had looked this way since his second year at Princeton. His graying blonde hair was unstylishly cut, on purpose. He disdained salon haircuts as marks of unseriousness.
"Good morning," Banion said to the camera. "Our guest today is the President of the United States. Thank you for being with us this morning."
"My pleasure," lied the President.
He had loathed John O. Banion ever since Banion had corrected him on a point of history at a White House dinner in front of the French president. He chafed at being told by his press secretary that Banion insisted on a live interview in the studio. What was the point of being the most powerful man on earth if you had to grovel before these assholes just because they had their own TV? "Sir, it's the top-rated weekend show," his press secretary had said, "and it looks like he's going to be moderating the debates this fall."
"All right, but you tell him no commercials. I won't sit there twiddling my thumbs while they break for commercials every 5 minutes. It's unpresidential."
"Mr. President," Banion said, "I want to ask you why, in light of your administration's below-par performance in a number of areas, you haven't fired at least 2/3 of your cabinet, but first..."
It was a trademark Banion opener. Establish the guest's inadequacy, then move along to the even more pressing issue. The president maintained a glacial equanimity. The press secretary would suffer.
"Let me ask you something else. We have a report that NASA, the space agency, is planning to advance the launch date of the final stage of the space station Celeste to right before the presidential election this fall. Would you call that a triumph of American aerospace engineering or of politics? You can take credit for both, if you'd like."
The president smiled, but inside his brain alarms were sounding like those on a depth-charged submarine. How did Banion know about the launch date? They'd gone to pains to put in so many buffers between the White House and NASA on this exquisitely delicate matter that no one would be able to trace the decision to the Oval Office.
John, the credit for Celeste's dazzling success has to go, first and foremost, to hundreds and thousands of men and women who have worked their hearts out on this project from the very beginning. Banyan jotted notes on his clipboard. He did this not because any of the drivel excurgitating like foam from the presidential mouth warranted recording, but because it made his interviewees nervous. To make sure that America will not only be number one here on Earth, but number one out there. 3.5 years ago, you gave a speech at an aerospace plant in the Mojave Desert in California, in which you called for completing an orbital space station. You called this an urgent national priority. Some cynical voices at the time suggested that, like President Kennedy, who announced the Man on the Moon initiative right after the Bay of Pigs fiasco, you were trying to get people's minds off the Korean debacle. But leave that aside for a moment. Let me, if I may, and leave aside the fact that Celeste's biggest contractors are in California and Texas, two states you almost lost 4 years ago, and which you desperately need to win this time. Let me ask you, after 4 years of cost overruns that would have made the Emperor Caligula blush crimson, what does the nation have to show for the celestial boondoggle, aside from the $3.4 million zero-gravity coffee makers and $1.8 million toilets? With all due respect, I'm sure there were some people in the court of King Ferdinand and Isabella who objected to the cost of the facilities on Columbus's boats. I don't recall there were facilities on the Nina, Pinta, and Santa Maria. My point is that you can't really put a price on the future. With all due respect, the fact is that you can put a price on anything. In this case, it's $21 billion and counting, as they say at Cape Canaveral. This is a huge sum of money. What's more, it's being said that your re-election committee should report this as a campaign donation by the American people. Fine, said the president, but let me tell you what I hear when I travel around this country in support of Celeste. I hear people saying, this is excellent. This is something we can all be proud of. So what are the American people getting for their billions? The president pressed play and, straining against the weariness of reciting it all for the 200th time, began to tick off the bountiful spin-offs that Celeste would bring to Earth. Glorious advances in machinery lubricants, sewage treatment, robotic wheelchairs, insulin pumps, pacemakers, radiation-blocking sunglasses, energy-conserving air conditioning. Banyan listened to this life-enhancing litany with the chin-quivering air of a man at pains to stifle a yawn. Sensing that he had better come up with something more millennial than Celeste's contribution to the field of ultrasound scanning, the president dragged out the Lawsy module, the ultimate, if slippery, argument for Celeste's relevance. If in doubt, refer to the Large Asteroid Warning System Indicator, which theoretically could detect whether some astral death star this way was heading. But it was tricky business, getting the citizenry in a lather over the prospect of death by gigantic meteor, especially this close to the millennium, when every fruitcake in the pantry was screaming apocalypse. But what, Banyan said, are we supposed to do if we find out there is an asteroid coming our way? Well, in the unlikely event, we'd want some sort of warning. I wouldn't. If the world's about to end, I don't want any warning. No one is saying the world is going to end, said the president, trying to smile. This is about beginnings, not endings. When he began to extol the racial and cultural diversity of the astronauts being launched, Banyan interrupted him. We'll be right back with the president after this. The studio filled with the sound of Ample Ampere's theme music. The commercial showed a basset hound sitting staring hopefully through the glass door of an oven, inside which a juicy roast was baking. The president gestured to his press secretary to approach, with his miserable, inadequate excuse as to why he, leader of the new millennium, was being made to endure.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?